Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and today's program is a sunny one.
It is. It's sort of about barbecue and sort of about a few other things thrown in as well.
Yes, gardens.
We're not thinking spring, we're thinking summer right now. And I'm sure you are too, wherever you are, unless you're on the other side of the world, in which case you just left summer behind and you're just perhaps thankful it's over or waiting for it to happen again. We're not sure which.
We ask a lot of our listeners.
We do, don't we?
But they're
all over the place. Yeah. So who knows what they're cooking down under? Who knows what they're cooking in Kiwi land?
Yeah, I don't know.
We have no idea what they're doing in Patagonia. We have no idea what they're doing in Chile. We have no idea what they're doing in South Africa. But I'm sure wherever you are, you're up to something and you're tuned into the On the Menu family. So we're glad that you're with us this morning. And, in case there is no tradition of sort of grilling, outdoorsy kind of cooking in your country, listen hard because it's a big thing in these United States. So we call this program Barbecue Plus because three of the tracks are real stars of the world of barbecue in different kinds of ways. First up, a surprising thing really, for those who don't know our country very well, you may not know that there's a major division between the North, the Yankees, and the South, the rebels, or whatever else you like to call them. And the rebels say they own barbecue. They own the use of all kinds of exciting spices and other elements to make the cooking really spicy. But remarkably, kicking off the program, a couple of guys from Boston who decided that they could do it just as well.
And it's a really good book.
And it's a really good book called Wicked Good Barbecue. And these guys cook Wicked Good Barbecue because they won essentially the world championship of barbecue.
Well, I'm looking forward to talking to Andy Husbands and Chris Hart about their book, Wicked Good Barbecue, and about their recipes, although personally, I would just rather have them come over and cook for me. Welcome to On the Menu. I love your book, and I love these recipes. I start out by telling, how did these two Yankees from Boston end up at the top of the heap, the king of the barbecue mountain?
Well, this is Andy, and I have to give props to Chris. He really, they say to become an expert, you need to spend 10,000 hours doing something, and Chris did well over that, just practicing and practicing. And that's really how you become great at anything.
Now, how did you decide to start? I mean, this is not the most usual kind of way that someone from Boston would make a living. Perhaps you don't even do it to make a living.
Yeah, we don't, this is Chris. We love going out and cooking barbecue. We certainly don't necessarily pay our bills doing it, but we've earned a good bit of prize money over the years, and mostly it just started with a group of seven guys going out for the weekend and drinking in a field and cooking with fire and just having a good time. And we saw these other teams winning trophies and winning big awards, and I decided, I'm a pretty competitive guy, and decided, you know what, I want to start winning some of these contests. So
Certainly have.
Yeah.
Including the biggest. Is this the biggest one, the Jack Daniel's World Championship?
The Jack Daniel's World Championship is generally regarded as the most prestigious, largest barbecue award you can win. And that's what everyone's going after every year. There's contests every weekend, all summer, all throughout the country. And that's what they're striving for, is to get invited and then to ultimately win it.
Okay,
and
so we did
do that.
So first of all, you have to be invited. So there must have been a prejudice you had to overcome already in order to be able to get in.
You need to win a state championship. So they try to get a team from each state. So we won the Massachusetts state championship,
okay,
and then that got us invited to the big show down in Lynchburg, Tennessee.
Do you remember, Rabbit, we interviewed somebody who had a killer barbecue sauce who was from New England.
Denny Mike from Maine.
Sure. I know Denny Mike, yeah. His great sauce.
Yeah, his stuff is really excellent. Both the dry rubs and the barbecue sauces are excellent. Although I have to say, we have one favorite on top of all of the others called Stubbs, which
goes... Stubbs makes great products. I use some of their products in our championship barbecue recipe.
Yeah, so you know the secret too. I mean, the stuff is absolutely wonderful.
It is phenomenal.
And Chris, were you a chef before, or were you just like a home barbecuing kind of guy?
I'm more of a home cook enthusiast. I've worked in the restaurant business, but normally in the front of the house, not professionally trained, but a very enthusiastic home cook with a real passion for barbecue.
And Andy, where do you fit in? Were you just friend of Chris?
Where do I fit in?
No, I mean, how did you?
Andy doesn't fit in very well, but other than that. I'm always on the outside. So this is Andy, yes. Well, you know, Chris and I went to high school together, and my path took me going to culinary school and working for the renowned chef Chris Schlesinger at the East Coast Grill, who kind of just turned Chris and I onto barbecue. And then Chris and I, we opened a restaurant together, and we've been best friends for many,
many
years.
What's the restaurant? Let's plug that.
That's my restaurant, which is Tremont 647.
Oh, okay. And that's
south
in
end of Boston, Mass. Yeah.
It's
oh, great.
It's probably on Tremont Street.
Exactly.
Yeah, I wonder where the name came from.
Now, you have the forewords written here by Steve Raiklin. Now, he's like the guy. He's the dude of barbecue, isn't he?
Yeah, one of the people that is very successful in the barbecue area, writes lots of great books.
Oh, I mean, I think we've had a ton of books from him.
We have.
And, yeah, and I was fortunate enough to work with him a couple times throughout my career, and he was very generous and gracious enough to write the foreword for the book.
Yeah, and Adam Harry Lang, he's back in the States, I understand, and he has this new book I've requested a review copy of called Chard and Scruff. We visited him when we were in London when he was there with Jamie Oliver, but he's since departed.
Yeah.
Another legend of barbecue.
Seems like
yeah,
he'd
he's very talented.
He seemed like he'd be there forever. The restaurant's called Barbacoa, and Banley got to talking to with Jamie Oliver, who's not had a failure among his restaurant empire, I don't think. Adam was over there. He took his whole family to London. They were having a wonderful time, and all of a sudden he's not there.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. Do you know anything about that?
You know, the restaurant industry is a magical, mysterious world.
It is, so. Okay.
Well, tell us, let's talk about this book. Now, you say that there are like two, well, let's start by saying that you say you do not cook any one style. You cook all the styles of barbecue. That you have in the book two main parts. They're not really parts, but one is like traditional barbecue information and recipes, and the other one is real off-the-wall stuff, right?
Yeah, well, this is Andy. It was really important for us to kind of get the science and the how-to of make high-quality, award-winning barbecue, and that is the main part of that book. And then we take the techniques that we've kind of outlined in the introduction, in the first chapter, and use them in the rest of the book with really fun things like roasting whole stripers or the $100 meatloaf, but all things cooked over hardwood and charcoal.
Recipes just look so delicious. Tell that there's chefing involved in here.
Yeah, one of the reasons for that is the photography. Our good friend Ken Goodman did the photography for the book, and we think that's one of the highlights for sure.
Oh, I was going to mention the photography's phenomenal, I think.
In fact, the gentleman who took the photos, Ken Goodman, he's on the front cover. He's one of our team members.
Which one's he? He's the one with the blue ribbon? No. You give away your secrets, supposedly, in the ribs that won the Jack Daniel's World Championship. What's your secret in that recipe?
Well, there's not one secret there. It's really a whole bunch of techniques that build on top of one another. And really with competition barbecue, you know, we've got different styles. There's some Texas barbecue and North Carolina barbecue. Competition barbecue is its own style. And what goes on with competition barbecue is you basically have one bite to get the judge's attention, right? So when you go to a restaurant, you'll eat a whole rack of ribs, and with competition barbecue, it's just over the top. It needs to be perfect, melt in your mouth, tons of flavor, and make a big statement. So that's what you're trying to do with competition barbecue. So we're layering flavors all through the process with injections and dry rubs and marinades and finishing dry rubs. And those layers is what makes that big statement that helps you win a barbecue contest.
Well, I don't think I could produce anything as gorgeous and luscious looking as what you're picturing here.
Well, no, this is Andy, and we believe you can. And that's what this book is about, is teaching people how to make the best barbecue ever. And in fact, read the recipe and go for it. But we believe that it's possible.
Yeah, and you give away all kinds of recipes for, like, special brines and that sort of thing. And just in the, oh, I love your titles, Chili from Hell, the Habanero Mash.
There's a lot of those flavors in there for sure. And there's some complicated recipes. There's some that are very simple. Like there's a lamb shank recipe that this just calls for a simple rub and slowly roasting it on your grill. So there's a pretty wide gamut of recipes in there. But for sure, some of the competition style food takes some effort.
And you have this section called Twisted Traditionals. What's in there?
That is kind of where we wanted to take traditional recipes and kind of jazz them up a little bit, make them a little bit different, a little bit funky, I guess.
Like the $100 meatloaf.
Yeah, so that would be a great example because, you know, meatloaf is a traditional item that everybody's had. So we said, you know, how can we make it a little bit different?
Well, one of the things in dried porcini mushrooms, they have to be good.
Yeah, but there's a chunk of something in the center, too. Looks like it might be foie gras.
It is foie gras.
It is. We had to make it $100 meatloaf somehow.
Yeah, exactly.
And here's foie gras and truffles.
Yeah,
absolutely.
One of the great things about this, the opportunity we had with our publisher is that when we sat down and thought about this book is when, like, the local newspaper calls us up and says, you know, can you have a barbecue recipe for us for Super Bowl weekend? They always say, dumb it down, make it simple. And what our publishers did, which was a really nice thing, is that they said, don't do that. Assume that all your readers are really barbecue enthusiasts and they want a challenge and they want to know all the details of what it takes to cook well enough to win a world championship. So we were really excited by that opportunity to really be able to dig into the details and kind of explore all the various techniques we've learned over the years.
Now, you have some fun, too.
A lot of fun.
I couldn't help but noticing the flower pot chicken. Flower pot jerk chicken.
Well, the flower pot was fun for us because we were kind of talking about a tandoori oven, and most people do not have a tandoori oven, but a lot of people have flower pots or access to a flower pot, and this is kind of the same principle of cooking where there's a heat at the bottom and it kind of becomes almost like a chimney where it roasts above. That was a fun recipe to work on.
But look, the picture in the book, it seems like there's a lot of burning going on. There's a lot of naked flame.
Yeah, well, it comes right up and roasts the chicken, the shrimp, whatever flower pot recipe you're doing.
Now, several years ago, we discovered not only beer can chicken, because beer can chicken's been known for some time, but we actually discovered someone who wrote a book called The Zen of Beer Can Chicken, and they actually created the device so that instead of using a beer can, you actually had a cooking device that was used for this purpose, which works a whole lot better, and you can actually use it in the oven, and it catches the beer as it flows down and then flows back up again. So it's a very superior way of doing beer can chicken. Did you develop any, like, tools and things like that as a result of working on the book?
Well, Chris really, you know, when we talk about this, you talked about the sous vide, which is, you know, the cooking underwater. That is, you know, a technique that I'm not sure I've ever saw it in a book before in regards to smoking, because he smokes the meat first, and then, slow cooks it in water. So we came up with some kind of, I wouldn't say we created any techniques, but we definitely embellished on what is already existing and kind of made it our own.
One of the key things we've done is we kind of blend maybe non-traditional techniques. So techniques we've learned in the restaurant business along with those that we've learned in the barbecue world. And there's a bunch of recipes where we kind of bring those two things together, we think, with some very interesting results.
Now, sous vide is one of them. Is there another one you could mention?
Well, another one is just kind of like braising, right? So that, like in the lamb shank one, we do one step where we kind of barbecue the lamb shanks, and then we have a second step where we braise them, and so that kind of makes it all kind of meltingly tender and fall apart type meat. And so that's just another example of kind of two techniques being used to create a dish.
And nice. You bake in a smoker too, which is
absolutely all this is done with hardwood charcoal or hardwood itself, and so we're really using kind of a very, and cooking over fires, you know, since the dawn of time. So we're really using these very traditional cooking methods in a very kind of new, creative way.
What about this chapter? You call it, Wait Till You Try This. Unbelievable results that take time. I was fascinated with this chapter.
Well, a lot of times, and as Chris is talking about with recipes, people want things that are very quick, easy. But not everything is quick that is good is quick and easy. In fact, I'd say the opposite. So Chris wrote this great recipe called Duck Duck Smoke. It's a process. But, man, that sandwich is one of the best sandwiches I've ever eaten. Duck pastrami in it. You know,
duck confit
in it. It's phenomenal.
Yeah. Those are kind of project recipes that you need to, put in a piece of your weekend. Wow. And a lot of times where they take a lot of time, they're not a lot of active time. So, for instance, like with the duck pastrami, you need to brine it for a day, but it takes you 45 minutes to pull it together. You trim the duck, you make the brine, you put it in there, you throw it in the fridge for 24 hours. So it's more, you know, it's not tons of active time, but you need to allocate a good chunk of your weekend to kind of pull off these recipes.
But now 6-day bacon. Sounds like
same idea.
That's a real time commitment.
Yeah, but again, there's a lot of brining and curing in there, so
okay,
it's
sure,
not like
sure.
You're actively cooking bacon for 6 days.
Now, Anne's favorite.
Yeah, I want this. I really do this. Jamie's pig ear tureen. It shows you all the little folds in the little piggy's ears. I love it.
Yeah. It is phenomenal. It's a great recipe.
How do I get some of that? I can't.
Come to Boston.
What?
Or come to Boston or just follow the recipe.
I don't even know. Well,
do you serve it at Tremont 376?
No, we actually, this is actually a recipe from my buddy Jamie. Jamie Bissonette, fabulous chef. He is the owner of Copa. And it's right, actually right near my restaurant, and it's, he serves it all the time.
Okay, so he does have it on his menu.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, great, because I'm not sure I know where we can source pig's ears.
Well, I don't even know where you can source popcorn ice cream. Here's popcorn ice cream sandwiches.
Popcorn ice cream is actually really easy. All you have to do is make popcorn, not the microwave style, the actual traditional in a pan, and soak it in your custard for about 24 hours or maybe 12, and then strain it. And then it has the popcorn flavor in it.
Does
pretty
it have butter and salt and things like that?
Well, well, I mean, that's what goes in when you popped in the corn.
Yeah, uh-huh. I mean, it's a very rich recipe. We do add salt when we put it in the machine, and that gives us just a real nice kind of popcorn flavor. You'd be amazed.
Well, this pig's head is rather arresting.
Some mixed opinions on that one. That was a little bit out there. We were being a little creative that day. But one of the things we love about cooking barbecue is not letting us, you know, we're gonna cook a pig. We're gonna cook every piece of it. We're not gonna let any of it go to waste. So that's how we use that.
I have one serious question. It worries me a little bit. Have you received any death threats?
Why?
Well, because they're in a very real sense, they're honing in on somebody else's territory. And the last time that was going on, it was 1861, and there was a big war.
No, we only got an accolades for this book. No death threats.
Okay.
You know, about your pig's head, it's called Lord of the Flies Roast with Jungle Curry Lettuce Wraps. You know what? The very first pig roast I ever did was in a rural Brown County, Indiana, and all the people that were invited out to this woodsy cabin with no plumbing, I might add, were city folk, and they were getting a little antsy about showing up. But then they got the spirit of the thing when the pig came out of the ground, and all these people that are city folks started cracking the skull on the pig's head and getting at the brains. So it does do something by transporting you back to your primitive nature.
No, they were just trying to gain some intelligence. They obviously didn't have very much, so they were trying to get some more.
Well, there wasn't an ounce of pig left. It was just amazing.
Well, thank you so much, guys.
You guys are really, I mean, this is a fabulous book. I mean, it's...
Yeah, let's...
Thank you very much.
Let's go back and make sure that...
Yeah, do you realize how many, at this time of year, how many barbecue cookbooks we get?
Hold on a second.
This pops out.
We need to repeat the title.
I'm going to do that. I will do that. I'm just going to do that. I just wanted to say something first. But the title is Wicked Good Barbecue, Fearless Recipes from Two Damn Yankees Who Won the Biggest, Baddest Barbecue Competition in the World. And the heads of the authors of the book are Andy Husbands and Chris Hart. And
Andy and Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Wonderful book.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
For the book.
And don't go away because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next up, I'm pleased to say, is an interview we did with Susan Erickson, who is a wonderful spokesperson for her company and its products called Char Crust. We enjoyed this product a lot. And we're going to have in the same segment something else that really engrosses me is, you know, I'm crazed over tomatoes.
You are?
Yes, I am. And Barry Estabrook he's an excellent writer. He's an excellent researcher. And this is a book to get us all thinking about what we're doing right and wrong, and mainly wrong
the
right
good,
now.
The good thing about Tomato Land is when he finished up, and when he was getting ready the book, he found out that, in fact, there was a good side to this.
Yes.
And the conditions that he found so disgraceful were really changed. And
changing, at least.
At least changing, yes. And just to put things in perspective, we avoid buying tomatoes as frequently as we can, but 10 months out of the year we have to. So we're consumers of the product that has been suffering really in the industrial hands, so we're glad to know there's a trend in the opposite direction. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention before we go on the air is that char crust is not only a great product, it's a great secret, because it's capable of adding just the flavor you want, whether you're cooking indoors or outdoors, whether you're barbecuing lamb or chicken or fish or steak. There's a product here that will make sure that you're more successful, that your guest, whoever it is, will love what you've done and will wonder what your secret is, and it'll be up to you whether you decide to tell them or not. So first of all, then in this segment, char crust, and then tomato land.
I don't know how it took us so long to get char crust into our larder, because Susan Erickson just told us that the product's been in existence since the 1950s, and it was an invention of a fine steak restaurant in Chicago that her father-in-law happened to own. So how come it took so long for us to get some?
Well, I would say it's because so many chefs wanted to keep it a secret themselves. My father-in-law's steakhouse, they were well-known for their char-crusted steaks, and the other chefs that over the years started to purchase the product once my father-in-law had retired and closed his restaurant, he sold it to the other chefs, and they wanted to make it their own secret, which we wholeheartedly embraced and encouraged them, because if they felt it was a big part of their success, we were really pleased with that ourselves.
So when did the change happen?
Which change is that?
That you started to offer it as a product in very handsome packaging, and some of it landed into our cupboard, and I guess it's on sale in fine food stores across the country. So when did you make that change?
Yes, that change happened about 20 years ago. I had met my husband, and he had kept char crust going more or less like a wonderful hobby, and sold it to chef, and again, primarily by word of mouth. And being he was courting me, and we were early in our dating years and dating days, and he had kept telling me about it, and I said, well, what is this stuff? Like to know more about it. He came over to my little apartment in Chicago and cooked some chicken with it, and my jaw dropped. It knocked my socks off. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. All he did was take the chicken, dredge it in this char crust, and it was just a dry rub seasoning, so kind of a granular product. He used the original, so it's sort of an espresso brown color, and dredged it in there, put it under the broiler, took them out, and they had made a char crust had formed on the outside of these chicken's breasts if he had cooked it on an outdoor grill. And when he cut into those chicken breasts, and the juice was running all over the plate and had this succulent meat inside, this crispy, delicious skin of seasonings on the outside, I just could not believe what I was seeing. And I just started to pester him about it and said, we have got to do something. And within a year, I had quit my job, my career, and we made a go of it.
Well, now, without giving away too many secrets, because there are lots of rubs. We've had dozens of them over the years, and they're all very good. They all add something. But char crust is doing something a little bit different. Now, without giving away the secret ingredient, how is char crust different?
Two ways that it's truly different are that one is the quality, and the level of quality that we use in the ingredients. Our spices are imported whole, so we can inspect them and make sure that they are the absolute tip-top best quality you can get. Then they are fresh ground, fresh blended, and packaged. We do all of that ourselves, and so you have very premium quality ingredients at their peak state. And the other thing I think is that I've been true to my father-in-law's original recipe. Any additional flavors that we've developed, we maintain similar proportions for some of the key ingredients in there. And by doing so, that has kept that family and that line of char crust similar in their performance. And again, just maintaining that super high level of quality.
So, but there's some kind of magic that your father-in-law, I guess, discovered when he put a certain amount of A, a certain amount of B, a certain amount of C together. Somehow it just worked.
Is it like a chemistry thing?
It seems to be, although the ingredients are very easy, easy to read, clean label. I'm not exactly sure. He and his chefs were brilliant in when they created those ratios and putting everything together. And like you said, it's absolutely magical what it does.
Yeah, there's some kind of chemical interaction taking place that I guess you probably just never bother to analyze because you just happen to know that it really worked well.
True. And, you know, I think that whole Maillard reaction that happens when you're searing a steak properly, that helps. Certainly, and broil, bake, grill, roast with our product, but certainly searing does work best to help make that crust happen. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that's something that has that provides a benefit to that crust happening as well.
Now, it started out as a steak rub, but you just mentioned chicken, and we've also used it with fish.
Fish, yeah.
We're having salmon tonight, and it's possible that one of the rubs might sneak its way onto the salmon. You can never tell. The line consists of how many different flavors and application combinations.
We have 9 flavors. We have our original hickory grilled, the hickory and molasses, roasted garlic peppercorn, which is one of our best sellers along with the original.
I remember using that one. And
that was the first one we used.
And what did you use that on?
I can't remember. I put one on fish. There's one that says it's good on fish.
Mm-hmm.
And whichever one it was, that was the one I used first. The hickory one I would only use on a steak because that's what it's optimized for. And then go through the others again for me very quickly.
Oh, we have, I ended with roasted garlic peppercorn. And then we also have smoky spicy Southwest, ginger teriyaki,
nice.
Amazing Cajun, sun-dried tomato and garlic, and then our all-American barbecue. And I have a new one coming out in 3 weeks.
Which is what?
Java Buzz.
Okay. Huh?
Oh, wow.
Coffee's good for that. It's really good.
Yeah, I've had some people with making rubs with coffee in them before.
Yeah.
And it really is rather special.
It is.
Now, how do people get this? Are you in stores or retailed online or what?
Both. We make it very easy. Folks can visit charcrust.com and use our store locator. Simply put in the zip code. And a list of stores should come up, as well as maps for retailers that carry it. We do tend to be more in specialty stores and some natural stores, and especially butcher shops. We're a natural for them, and seafood shops as well. And if folks can't find us in a location that's convenient for them, we are more than happy to ship directly to anybody who would like to get it.
Okay, so first go to the website, listeners. Check out to see if somebody near you is handling the product, and then if, in fact, you can't find it that way, then order it online. Is that correct, Susan?
That's correct. Exactly, Anne. Thank you.
Yeah. Now, it's really interesting. Two things about it, about char crust, have fascinated. One is that the color, when you open the container, pour the stuff out, it's very unassuming look. It's just sort of an odd sort of mid-browny color. This doesn't look like it would really do very much good at all.
That sounds like the original, yes.
and then when you put it on, this magical thing happens, and it darkens considerably. I noticed that it doesn't burn. Now, one of the shortcomings of some of the rubs we get is that they have quite a lot of sugar in them, and that sugar tends to burn under the grill, especially if you're doing it indoors under an overhead broiler. And yours goes dark, and it looks like maybe it's burned, but it's not. You probably know, I'm sure you knew that, but I discovered that, because I was worried that I was cooking it too long, and as a result, I would get a burnt flavor rather than a charred flavor.
Well, when my husband first cooked it for me, and you remember we were dating, I liked him. And so when he took the chicken out, and I thought the same thing, oh my gosh, he's burnt the chicken. And I thought, well, I really like this guy, so I'm just going to be polite and eat the chicken and tell him what a marvelous chicken it was. And to my delight, I did not have to fib one bit.
That's amazing. So listeners, bear that in mind, because otherwise you might be worrying. And you really don't need to. This is a battle-tested recipe, right? It was designed.
It is in many restaurants. And I think the name we had when we did decide to do something with this and add other flavors to the line, we had debated about whether or not to change the name of the product. And I was a firm advocate of no. This is what it does. It makes a char crust, and so people could expect and know what it was doing just simply by the name.
Right. So we only have one more piece of advice left for listeners, don't we? And that is, if you want to have a successful date or anything else for that matter, if putting a very satisfactory, shall we say, Maillard crusted surface on your meat or your fish, this is the way to go about doing it. And www.charcrust.com, again, is where you can figure out where to get some.
And Susan is a wonderful spokesperson for this company.
She is. She is.
Go, Susan.
Thanks, Anne. Thank you, Peter.
Mary Estabrook shines at investigative reporting, and I've been after him a long time to have a chat about this book called Tomato Land, which I guess I finally ended up getting around the time it came out in paperback, which is good because everything changed, has been changing so fast that there's an afterword that kind of shifts the emphasis a little bit. Welcome to On the Menu, Barry.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, well, you certainly did a bang-up job in this book. I didn't know, first of all, that things were as bad as they were. I didn't know all the things that were wrong with tomato growing in this country, and I was pleased to see that there have been significant changes in the area of improvement.
I really set out to use the winter tomato as kind of a poster child for a lot of things that are generally wrong with industrial agriculture.
Yeah, I loved your opening with the truckload of, what did you think they were?
I thought this was in Florida, and they were full of bright green things that I thought were apple, Granny Smith apples. So I realized that they don't grow in Florida.
And that started you, and you got involved with Gourmet, with Ruth Reichel, and you got stimulated in the direction of actually investigating into this issue. And were you startled to find out all that was going on?
Well, I'm still startled, even every time I think about it. I really did. You're right. I sort of came into it looking into what happened to the wonderful taste and texture of a real tomato, how come it got lost in industrial production. And then while I was researching that, the newspapers down in southwestern Florida reported this horrific case involving abject slavery. This was a group of people who, locked people in trucks at night, chained them, beat them for not working hard enough, didn't pay them, and then I found out it was common.
How did they get away with it? Just because they could, huh? There was a wink in them.
Well, they get away with it because it's one of these problems that can hide in plain sight. The people are, many of them don't speak English. They're desperate people, the workers, and they're not the type of people that attract a lot of attention or want to bring a lot of attention to themselves. So it flies under the radar.
They weren't even paid living wage or minimum wage.
They were paid nothing in many cases and forced to work and threatened to be, executed if they tried to run away. Even the best of tomato pickers, even the guys who are at the top of the socioeconomic ladder in tomato picking, are lucky to make minimum wage.
Startling, absolutely startling. And the other thing, no idea that, didn't feel that it was right, but I had no idea that this probably, South Florida is the worst climate to ever try to grow tomatoes in, period.
Well, that struck me as counterintuitive at first because we all think of Florida as the sunshine state.
Right.
But it could also call itself the humidity state.
Yeah.
And anything that would destroy a tomato plant, any germ, any bug, any bacteria thrives in fungus, or if thrive in humidity. And Florida's very humid year-round. Tomatoes, wild ancestors, were adapted to live in some of the most arid places in the world, Western South America, from Chile up to Ecuador. And that's why tomatoes do so well in places like Italy, with Mediterranean climate, because you have endless sunny days during the summer with no rain.
Just had this discussion with my greengrocer that after reading your book, I think that he was delusional. He told me about his friend who invented or discovered or produced in some fashion cherry tomatoes and how it made him a billionaire. But you tell the opposite story, is that they started out marble-sized, and then the trick was to get them to grow large.
Well, the wild, the immediate ancestor to the plants that we now grow as tomatoes still grows in Peru, and I actually went down there. And you're exactly right. They look like miniature cherry tomatoes. They're not much bigger than a blueberry or a currant or a cranberry at the biggest. But they look like tomatoes, and they taste like tomatoes. And in prehistoric times, they were domesticated, and you're right. People kept choosing for bigger and bigger fruits until we ended up with every tomato we know today.
What else? Was there anything else that surprised you about the early history of tomatoes?
Well, there's a lot of things that are intriguing and kind of mysterious about the early history of tomatoes. First of all, tomatoes grow wild in South America, but they were domesticated in southern Mexico, and no one knows how they weren't domesticated by the people who lived in the area that they were native to. And then the second thing was, when the Europeans brought them,
with all sorts of strange attributes. Now, some of them were thought to be aphrodisiacs. Some of them were thought to be poisonous.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them were just grown because people thought the fruits looked pretty. They were an ornamental. They didn't bother eating. And it was quite a length of time before people actually started to cook with tomatoes.
Well, when did this whole messy situation in Florida and commercial growing tomatoes start?
The industry has its roots, so to speak, back in the late 1800s. There's a case recorded of the first person to export tomatoes from Florida to the north, and he had all the ingredients that the vast industry today still has. One, they were out of season, of course. He grew them in the wintertime. Two, they were picked green, not ripe, and they were shipped north and ripened on the way. And three, they were priced cheaply, so people up north could afford this novelty. It really didn't get going as a big industry, though, until the embargo was placed on Cuba. Up until that point, it was always competing, the Florida industry, with Cuba. But once Kennedy signed the embargo, the industry in Florida took off. And today, a multi-million dollar industry controlled by very, very large farms. It's not like small farmers. These are people who farm thousands of acres.
Now, your book is filled with characters. How did they all end up in growing tomatoes? I mean, there's one right after another.
You know, I don't know, but it's true. It's one of those businesses where people kind of get bitten by the tomato bug and become fanatical about it in various ways and dedicate their lives to this intriguing plant.
Now, I was partway through reading one of your little vignettes when you called us to start the interview. So perhaps you can finish off the story. This was about the guys who grew tomatoes, and I think they must have been good guy tomato growers, not bad guy tomato growers. And they wanted to sell their crop to Whole Foods. So they went to Whole Foods and they bought one of every kind of tomato that Whole Foods had in stock. And then they added one of theirs, which was a variety that was new and exciting. What happened with the rest of the story?
Well, that group had its roots with research done by a professor at the University of Florida, a plant breeder called Jay Scott, and he's kind of the Luther Burbank of tomato breeding. He spent his whole career breeding tomato varieties. He was bound and determined to create a tomato that was going to be tough enough to withstand the rigors of industrial production and shipping, and yet deliver real tomato flavor. There was no reason in his mind why the two were mutually exclusive, and he worked for decades and finally came out with a variety that he called Tasty Lee. And you're right, it's been sold commercially for the last couple of years. It's hard to find outside of the state of Florida at this point, but it soon will spread. And his sales, the first sales call they made to Whole Foods was exactly that. They picked up every tomato in a Whole Foods store and one of theirs and went to the produce manager and said, taste it. And now, say, it's spread to other stores in Florida and the Southeast and will soon be available nationwide, I predict.
Oh, wouldn't that be wonderful? Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing?
It's not a perfect summer tomato.
But well, you can't catch that.
It is a tomato that has genuine tomato flavor. So it's nothing will ever equal what you get at the farmer's market or grow in your garden. But at least this tastes like something.
Now, I've read someplace else, and I can't remember where, this all about Tim Stark and his adventures. He's called the Tomato Man. Did you write about him before in Gourmet, or where did I read about him?
Well, there's a chapter about him in my book, and he's written his own book. You may have read it. He wrote a very intelligent and amusing memoir called Heirloom about how he became a sort of an accidental tomato farmer. I mean,
right.
He was a city-dwelling consultant.
Oh, is he the guy from the
yes.
Northwest?
He lives in Pennsylvania. He lives
okay.
Near Allentown, Pennsylvania.
I'm thinking of somebody else then.
Yeah.
No, but I think we saw the book. Because the story was very it's about him.
Well, he was a consultant and struggling writer in Brooklyn and got carried away one day growing seedling tomatoes from seed in his apartment.
His landlord basically kicked
all these seedlings out, said, what's going on here? And so Stark and several friends took all these seedlings, there were 1,000 of them or something, out to some land his mother owned in Pennsylvania a couple of hours.
Yeah, we interviewed this guy, right?
No, I do remember. We have interviewed him. Now I remember the story.
Yeah, and they spent a weekend or two putting in these 1,000 seedlings, and all of a sudden he was in the tomato business because the tomatoes grew and thrived that year. Now it's almost 20 years later, and he's made a success of it by selling great tomatoes to the most prominent restaurants in New York City, as well as through the green market.
There were rogues, a lot of them having to do with not only the growers, but also the men and supermarkets and so forth in the story. But as I said, I'm glad I waited for the paperback because you have an afterword in there that gives us hope. Do you want to tell our listeners about the changes that happened in less than a year, right?
It's been incredible. I mean, I think it's safe to say that in the last couple of years, the tomato industry has gone from being one of the most repressive agricultural sectors in the country for its workers to one of the most enlightened. And really what's happened is it was a grassroots workers movement from this small group of workers that started out small anyway in southwestern Florida. And they have convinced major tomato buyers to adopt something that they call the Fair Food Campaign, which gives workers a penny more a pound, which sounds like nothing to you and I, but it's the difference between $50 and $80 a day to a tomato worker. And also a handful of very, very basic labor rights that the rest of us take for granted. Punch clocks, so that the workers are credited for the time they work. Before there were none. Little patches of shade, usually those tents you see, those pop tents you see set up at farmers markets, are now in the fields so that they can get a bit of shade for their lunch breaks or if one suffers a heat stroke or something, there's shade. That was never before in the fields. There's a grievance procedure set up so that if someone has a problem, he or she can now report it. And it goes down the line. So for the first time, there's hope for this industry that was so, you know, so repressive. And I sort of think if it can happen in the tomato industry, it can happen in any agricultural sector.
Well, there's much need. I mean, I don't think they ever straightened out the plum cots. So, but your book, I'm sure, Barry, has helped bring attention and shine a spotlight on this issue. So thank you for your contribution to solving this problem.
Well, thank you for having me on to talk about it.
Great. And what's your next project?
You sound like my agent. I've got to figure that one out real soon.
Well, don't forget plum cots, except that we wrote a book about it already.
Well, be sure to let us know about it as you get started.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Thanks, thank Barry.
And we'll be back with the final segment right after this short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again, and we have to thank Karen Adler for this, her latest book. So you have a garden and you have a grill, and it just seems to be intuitive that you put them together, but somehow I didn't see as far-reaching as Karen did, and she's nailed it all by her book called The Gardener and the Grill.
We've been having such a good time talking to Karen Adler, we almost didn't get this interview done at all. and I'm worried about something. So I'm going to be very direct.
Oh, no, that's a bad thing.
I'm ready.
I'm worried that girls are invading barbecue.
And, yes, we are.
And the conversation that we had before we started recording this interview was so long and wide-ranging that I'm wondering how you'd ever get anything cooked. And yet you obviously do, because you have an incredibly thorough book.
I was going to say that this is called The Gardener and the Grill. The bounty of the garden meets the sizzle of the grill. And it goes where other barbecue books that we get
don't go.
Yes, we have a teeny bit of smoke in this book, but it is primarily grilling, and then, of course, some indirect grilling.
But you go into the marinades and the sauces and the flavored butters and all those good things. You go into freezing stuff that you've smoked. I didn't quite get that. Didn't you use it later for sandwiches or what?
So if you're smoking something and it takes a little bit more time, and let's say your tomatoes, your Romas off of the vine are perfect for smoking, why smoke two for one recipe? Why not smoke six or a dozen and then put those up, put the smoked tomatoes up so you can use them in soups and stews in the wintertime, fresh from your garden?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, but the other amazing thing about the book is the way you interweave the recipes with the kinds of things that you get out of a home garden, which is exactly what we have, except I'm sure it's not nearly as ambitious as yours.
Well, and that's what we wanted to make sure that we covered obviously the most common garden vegetables, and we weren't going to put bananas in this book because in the continental U.S.,
right,
very few people would have success having a banana tree in their backyard.
I had somebody tweet me that they had a special event for which they acquired fresh bananas from Pittsburgh.
Right, but that would be one out of how many?
I have no idea.
I think it was probably phony.
Right, and then we did include grapefruit because the whole southern United States, when you visit, people have citrus trees and grapefruit trees in their backyard, and so a grilled, quote, grilled, it's really more of a grilled and then sort of broiled grapefruit from the grill is fabulous.
Well, now let's go back to first principles here for a second, because you're Karen and you had a partner in this venture called Judith.
Yes.
Judith Fertig. Why did you decide that this is something that you absolutely had to do?
We've always loved having vegetables on the grill, cooking vegetables on the grill, and we've done several barbecuing and grilling books together, and we have always found that we had lots of recipes for the vegetable chapter, and then we had to cut them back because the vegetable chapter kept growing. And when this book came to be, which it started as a vegetables on the grill book, and then we decided, no, gardener in the grill. And that came from a love of Amanda Hesser's book, The Cook and the Gardener.
Oh,
and,
yes.
Mm-hmm, and yeah. She, you know, that was the story of she and Monsieur Milbert at La Varenne at Chateau de Fay, which Anne Willen owned. And we loved that book, and there were several of us that stayed at Chateau de Fay, and we visited Monsieur Milbert's garden, which is fabulous. And I think we brought back a lot of his gardening to our own yards, too. And then when Vegetables on the Grill became a book that our publisher wanted to do, it just fell into place to have it be the gardener and the grill.
This is not a barbecue book for your regular just slap something on the grill outside on a Sunday afternoon kind of barbecue, or is it?
It would be a great book for vegetarians and flexitarians and anybody that does like to put a steak on the grill, but you go ahead and you grill the vegetables on the side along with it. And then the other thing that we add is our love of all of the marinades, the rubs.
Good recipes for that stuff, too.
And you can see a lot of French and Italian influence in the sauces that we like, too, which isn't in a typical barbecue book.
Right.
Not hard.
Grilled green onion, mayonnaise, lemon, garlic, aioli. You're very fond of grilled green onions, aren't you?
Well, onions, think about it. When you cook, a lot of times one of the essential ingredients is onions. So we grill onions and green onions, red onions, whatever color, include those in our recipes because they have so much flavor.
Mm-hmm. But you don't let them fall through the grill.
No, you can use a grill rack. And one of the other fun utensils that we like, and this was, oh my gosh, 20 years ago, I bought a grill wok, which is similar to a grill basket, but it's shaped more like a wok with the perforation. And the whole idea was thinking about stir-grilled vegetables and the eye appeal. And one of the first recipes I created was so simple, yet so good. Salmon, sugar snap peas, red cherry tomatoes, and red onion. And for more color, you could add yellow teardrop tomatoes and some multicolored peppers as well. And the grill, that little bit of caramelization that you get from the grill is just so wonderful. And then the eye appeal of mixing all of those colorful vegetables together is delightful.
Now, tell me about your peppers. You roast your peppers whole, and then you seed them, and I always do it the other way around.
Well, actually, we do it both ways.
Oh, you have it both ways, okay.
We do it both ways, yes. The whole pepper, and then in the paper sack, and you can easily pull the wonderful meat away from the seeds. But we will cut them and quarter them and grill them that way and even sliver them and put them in a basket or on a grill rack.
Yeah, you even have recipes for skewering things on like lemongrass and rosemary stems and things.
Yes, it's fun and it's flavorful. And if you're a gardener, you have those things. So we even have skewered late in the year when our basil has basically quit producing.
Mm-hmm.
We don't throw away the basil or the lemon balm stems. We'll use those for skewers, too.
Wow. You have a whole section on flatbreads and pizza, which I think is interesting.
Yes. The poppy seed naan is so simple and so delicious. The homemade bread, a little bit of butter on the dough after it's risen. It only takes about an hour. And then a sprinkling of poppy seed, and it is heavenly.
I've decided this isn't a book. This is a way of life.
It's an attitude, yeah.
Thank you.
No, it totally is. It's a way of life. It's weaving your garden together with your gorilla.
Yeah.
And then you have to dedicate yourself to this. I mean, this is not a book you can open up to page 50, I think, and just say, I'll fix that recipe. I think there's a...
Well, let's see what 50 is.
I'm just being totally arbitrary, and I'm saying that I really think that for people to get the maximum value out of this book, they need to sign on to your mindset. So they need to take some time to just read the book and understand what you're trying to do before they do anything about cooking a recipe.
Well, thank you, Peter. And I think we've given them a good read because it's more than just the recipes.
Oh, it is. No question about it. Now see, here's the wrinkle. Here's where you need to put the beets on the grill hole.
You are right.
Because you found us out.
The
reason I'm saying this is because then you'll have time to read the book.
Oh, that's true.
Because I didn't discover grilling beets larger than tennis balls on the grill. My mother-in-law used to boil them on the top of the stove.
Yeah.
And it took a long time.
Yeah.
Now, you get a good family-sized beet, and it would take an hour and 15 minutes to cook.
That's true.
I thought, well, rather than fire up a pan on top of the stove, if I've got the grill going, why don't I just take the same beet that she was going to boil and put it on the grill? But in trying to figure out the cooking time, I realized the cooking time would be the same length of time as it was to boil that same beet on top of the stove.
Right, and depending on the size of the beet, because you would get a variety of sizes.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
And I think, you know, the other thing that's great, too, is a lot of times on the vegetables and on the fruit, you can actually put them on the grill without olive oil or without butter, if you wanted to use that for the fruit, because they're juicy to begin with, and they have the natural sugars when they're heated that come to the surface, and you know, they just taste twice as good once they've been cooked just a little bit.
I like to use the oil because I think the oil and the salt and pepper that you can get to cling to the surface by using oil. I think, to me, that's the way I go about a vegetable on the grill. But I'm obviously going to have to try your way because you're clearly much more expert than I am, so I'm going to have to give you a try.
But, Peter, I think that, and we know this from all of the cooking and the cookbooks and everything that we've seen and done ourselves, that there's more than one way to accomplish the task of a recipe.
I want this blackened fish po' boy with green onion mayo.
There's more than one way to skin a cat, too.
Yes, there is.
We don't grow that.
But you don't have a recipe for that.
Thank goodness.
Oh, dear.
Karen, you and your colleague...
It's very creative. The recipes are interesting, way beyond technique. They're just really good recipes.
I bet Steve Raiklin's, he's shivering in his boots.
Oh, he's a good friend.
He'll
be in Kansas City in a few weeks, and he's a good friend. So I think our book is totally different than his, too, and that's what we wanted. We wanted... This is really the most unique book that we've done, and our publisher, Running Press, did such a beautiful job designing it, and it's very green, and there is a lot of garden as well as food photography in it.
Yeah, photography is excellent.
There is. So I'm going to have to saddle up, I guess, find me a vegetable, and fire up the grill, and off I go, and I thank you, Karen, and I thank Judy in her absence for redirecting me along the proper path.
Well, it was a pleasure.
Karen, fun to talk to you as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
So that's a wrap for this week at On the Menu Radio. We'll look forward to seeing you again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.